When the Reverend Rob Shank walked away from a powerful leadership position on the evangelical right in this country, it was his reversal on absolutist anti-abortion positions that got the most attention, as did his renouncing his harsh anti-gay beliefs. But this transformation came as the result of a school shooting that compelled him to expose gun idolatry that he saw as rampant in the church. Now, with another massacre of school children prompting some measure of reflection among many Americans, and hostile circling of the wagons among pro-gun forces, for whom Texas has long been the promised land, we wanted to get a look at what the dynamics seem to be that keeps so many on the religious right impervious to the human suffering that results from their rhetoric. Rob, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Jack. It's always a pleasure.
So, Rob, by your estimation, how prevalent is an absolutist view on the Second Amendment among the influential political evangelicals you knew so well?
Well, I'd have to distinguish between private and public convictions on that, because I believe there are secret doubters who are compelled by their constituencies, by their fundraising operations, and certainly by their vote-getting operatives to take a different public directed stand. I'd say there's privately, there's a mix of opinions, but publicly, it's overwhelmingly supportive of an unfettered, unqualified embrace of what they would classify as Second Amendment gun rights. So the right of an individual to purchase any weapon for any reason and carry it openly at any time, anywhere in the United States, and actually in their minds around the world, because it's a God-given right. So it's an overwhelming embrace of what I call popular and reckless gun culture.
So I'm fascinated by this notion of private versus public conviction. And you know better than most, Rob, that when you change your mind on something essential to your imagining of yourself, it's not a switch that flips. It is something that happens over a period of time, even if you can identify a starting point. What is it that prevents people who are influential and in these and in the mode of private conviction about the need for certain limitations on the Second Amendment? What is it that prevents them from using their bully pulpit to do the right thing?
Well, partly, and I say this with a certain measure of sadness, my religious community, that is white American evangelicals, do not engage in critical thinking. It's first of all, not part of the ethos, the culture. Secondly, it's deemed to be contrary to faith, that faith is an absolute, unquestioned obedience to the dogma, the collective consensus of the evangelical Christianity. You know, of course, we have no hierarchies. Virtually every evangelical church is autonomous. Every congregation is autonomous. So it's a collective opinion. And sadly, stronger than that, lamentably, I alluded to it before, but the fundraising, vote-getting, and celebrity element of American evangelicalism has dominated, utterly dominated the church now for arguably 40 years. And as a result, to challenge any of the dogma that emits from these communications, millions upon millions, I mean, hundreds of millions of emails every year, thousands of websites, hundreds of major publications, lots of celebrity preachers and voices and so forth. And they have all agreed that the notion of an empowered constituency, giving individual evangelical Christians the power to defend themselves, principally against a federal government they hold in great suspicion, is not only necessary and constitutionally protected, but is actually a spiritual obligation to protect oneself, one's family, one's fellow believers against the imagined threat. Is actually a divine obligation. So that's the place that we're in. And as a result, I think we are fostering a very, very dangerous subculture in American life.
Wow. Your mentioning of a rejection of critical thinking has guaranteed that you'll be back on the show at some point in the future to talk with me about public education and its emphasis on critical thinking. But since I've raised the subject of schools, sadly, mass shootings, including of school children, are nothing new in this country. In your experience, how did pro-gun religious conservatives reconcile public tragedies like the one in Texas this week with their deeply held beliefs, especially of the sanctity of life?
Well, the best way I can explain that is through referencing a sermon that I carried around all over the country during my halcyon days in the religious right wing. And it was all about Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And you know, blame shifting and deflecting responsibility. So when God holds Adam to account, he points to his wife, to Eve, who points to the serpent, and ultimately to the creator of the serpent. And fingers are going everywhere except to one's own, you know, heart and soul. I wish I would have listened more carefully to my own sermon in those days, because I did plenty of that myself. And there is a deflection. There's a blame shifting that occurs. So it's not the recklessly irresponsible politicians that we have helped elect to office or get appointed. It's sin, Satan, the devil, the evil of the human heart. Neither we nor the people that we sponsor are to blame here. It's someone or something else. Ultimately, it's that serpent in the garden. And by the way, you know, God made the serpent. So ultimately, you know, God allows these things. We don't know why, and we dare not ask why.
You are someone who has dissented, and you dissented very publicly. But there are millions of people who listen to these messages week in and week out. There must be dissent somewhere. How is dissent handled if someone dares to speak up and say, this doesn't sound right to me?
Well, here's where I get a little hopeful about my tribe, because dissent is first whispered and tentatively, like, you know, I have these thoughts. I don't know if they're right, but sometimes I think, and then maybe their interlocutor sends back a positive signal. Yeah, I have those thoughts too. And sometimes I wonder if, and then they decide to tell a third, and the third says, boy, I've been thinking the same thing, and it's not just me. There are others too. And suddenly you get at least some kind of momentum. And because everything is done by consensus in the evangelical world, or at least by a kind of acquiescence, whoever has the loudest voice and starts speaking over others tends to start carrying an argument. And up until now, that's been entirely the boorish, I think, dangerous, thoughtless, and contemptuous voices within the evangelical community. But there are a whole lot of other really good people. I know them, but they are afraid to speak because they will be punished. Socially isolated, if not ostracized. They will be besmirched, probably called, at least a doubter, if not a child of the devil, rebellious, and so forth. So there's a lot of fear that keeps those voices suppressed. But if we can foster them and help them, and I hear from them every day, Jack, I hear from pastors, lay people, a lot of young people, of course, to be expected, who say, I feel the same way you do, or I was ahead of you. And we're starting to see a community build. And that's the only hope there is for American evangelicalism. If not, I believe we're on our way towards first a moribund religious movement. How long it may survive, I don't know. But and we could get very dangerous along the road to our demise.
Well, that's worth diving into. But first, I want to ask you about another term that is certainly problematic in the circles you used to run in, and that is intersectionality. It is a term and a strategy that has brought a lot of progressives together by tying different but compatible priorities to each other. Is there a potential for doing the same thing across the lines of the anti-abortion movement and the preservation of life already born, or is the rhetoric already too ubiquitous to allow for that?
Yeah, I'm afraid we're past that point with the middle-aged and older, members of my community who carry the day because first, they are elders.
Because they carry the checkbook.
And they most certainly carry the checkbook. Whoever has the disposable income or is funding the major evangelical organs of communication. And if you look at the demographics, it's generally 55 and older. So with that crowd, I'm not very hopeful at all. In fact, I'm quite pessimistic. But with younger evangelicals, I do think there's the possibility of fostering this new discussion and turning the direction of this very unwieldy ship towards a more salutary path. And I'm hopeful. Just yesterday, I spoke with Mike Goldsworthy of the post-evangelical movement, which actually isn't quite post-evangelical in the sense that many still identify as evangelicals, but don't adhere to the current social or even doctrinal orthodoxy. There are some very strong and organized dissenting voices. And again, that's the reason I maintain a little bit of hope for the future, the mid to distant future, in the immediate, I'm afraid we're lost.
Wow. So I know that you've given thought to this issue and the latest massacre in particular, not just as a faith leader yourself, but as president of the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Institute. Could you speak a little bit about this issue from the perspective of someone who is an acolyte and admirer of Bonhoeffer?
Well, sure. You know, the one thing I learned from Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who incidentally, you know, was an ordained minister, member of the clergy in Germany, they used the term pastor, an ordained pastor in the Evangelische Kirche, the evangelical church of Germany. Now, that means something a lot different than what we mean here by evangelical, but there's a common trunk of the tree there. And evangelicals admire Dietrich Bonhoeffer, this young, brave, brilliant German church leader during the rise of Adolf Hitler and Nazism in Germany and later, of course, in Europe. And he was one of the first dissenting voices and would pay for that with his life at age 39. But he was brilliant. You know, his first dissertation at 21 and his second dissertation at 23. That says a lot for that era in German academia. And Bonhoeffer taught me too late in my life. I wish I would have listened to him much earlier, but late in my life and career, I learned from him that moral relativism is actually a part of the Christian gospel. I didn't know that. And in fact, I preached and taught and lived to the contrary for too many decades. But in this sense, that the moment in time may demand something from us that we find at least uncomfortable and sometimes abhorrent, but it's required in that moment. And we have to humble ourselves enough to step outside our own preferences, our own demands, our own fantasies, frankly. You know, in my 30-odd years, you know, of being an evangelical clergy member, I had developed a whole fantastical image of what the world is, and then had some very painful experiences meeting reality. And Bonhoeffer deals with this question of reality. So it's a very long way of answering your simple question. And it's this, that just because the New Testament says that we can buy a sword, that Jesus allowed his disciples to buy a sword, doesn't mean that we're also allowed to take an AR-15 battle grade weapon into a schoolroom and slaughter tykes, tiny tykes. Some reason in the evangelical mind, absolutes allow for an outcome that may be beyond our capacity to rationalize, to justify, but it just has to happen because we have these God-given rights weirdly, codified in a governmental secular instrument, the Constitution, at least the way American highly politicized evangelicals see it. And what I learned from Bonhoeffer was to separate those things, to uncouple them. And, I learned, Jack, that in the evangelical veneration of the Second Amendment, we often end up violating the second commandment against crafting our own, idols. And I see the evangelical embrace of gun culture as a form of idolatry. Well, Bonhoeffer helped me to see that. And so Bonhoeffer's code of ethics, I think, is a very helpful way of meeting the challenges of our own time. And that's what we try to do through our new institute, imperfectly, of course, as Bonhoeffer said about himself, but we're trying. We're trying. So if anyone's not familiar with Bonhoeffer, you can learn a lot about him at our website, ddbi.org, but it's better to read his magnum opus, Ethics, and then you'll really get how helpful he is in our own era.
I'm smiling not just at your concise explication of what you learned from your mentor ancestor, but because just this week I heard a teacher of mine quote Abraham Joshua Heschel about idolatry, and your introduction of it here is important. Heschel said, any God which is my God but not your God is idolatry. And it's very relevant to what you just said. You know, the simple truth is countries with far fewer guns have far fewer murders, and not just shootings, but killings in general.
Well, now you give me a chance to go back to my dear Bonhoeffer, because he spoke of the moment, you know, when we can no longer simply bandage the wounds of those who fall under the car that's careening down the mountain. We must seize control of the vehicle. We must, he said, thrust a bar into the spokes of the wheel and stop the careening danger. I think we're at that point now. We cannot wait for all the stars to align and have more bodies lying dismembered in grocery store aisles or in elementary school classrooms. We can't. It's so despicable what is happening. It's intolerable. So now we just simply must act. We have to speak. We have to act. I heard some criticism today for Beto O'Rourke's recent confrontation of Texas Governor Greg Abbott in the aftermath of the Uvalde child massacre, is what I'm going to call it. And people said he was uncouth and maybe too political, even though they like him. I don't think so. I think we're past time for those sorts of, I like to call them prophetic confrontations. So we speak, we act, and we wait at the same time, patiently. Maybe we deliver some ultimatums, but maybe those ultimatums don't yield anything. And if not, then we just keep acting in a kind of impatient patience. That's the only way I can describe it.
So this is a very complicated subject that requires a complicated solution, which means I'm about to ask you a very unfair question. What is the thing you want people to be thinking about in just a few words at a time like this?
Well, first is, what can I do? My wife, Cheryl, kicks me under the table and says, you just talk way too much about Bonhoeffer. So, but he did say, the question was, what is the will of God for me in this moment? So I like to ask that question. What can I do? What can I say? How can I act? How can I influence? It is a time for every person of conscience to do or say something, or both.
The Reverend Dr. Robert L. Shank is founder and president of the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Institute and the author of a powerful change of heart memoir titled Costly Grace, An Evangelical Minister's Rediscovery of Faith, Hope, and Love, in which I mentioned, I'd just like to add. Rob, I really appreciate you taking this time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you.